Welcome to Bedford County Speaks, a weekly public affairs program that introduces you to the work, lives, and lifestyles in Bedford County. Today's program over News Talk 1310 WBFD is hosted by Lloyd Roach. Bedford County Speaks is heard every Saturday at this time. Now let's join Lloyd for this week's discussion on Bedford County Speaks.
Thank you, Matt DeFazio, and good morning to you. Welcome to Bedford County Speaks. Today's program is brought to you as a public service by DestinationDelco.com. Just to the east of you, you can find the wonders of historic Delaware County and the Brandywine Valley. And by Thomas Chevrolet Subaru, right here on Route 220 in Bedford. Thomas Chevrolet Subaru, where buying a car is always worry-free. I'll be right back to introduce my guests, Laszlo and Melinda Zongor, when Bedford County Speaks continues.
You got a minute? I want to tell you a story. Have you heard about Destination Delco? We're great bars and restaurants. We're ethnic neighborhoods. We're the Main Line and the Brandywine. We're different things to different people. We're a little brassy, but oh so classy. We're main streets and back roads, marinas and museums. We're nightlife and, yes, wildlife. We're Destination Delco, a new way to experience Delaware County.
In the interest of full disclosure, my guest today are literally across the street from where I live, so there was no excuse for not coming over to speak with them. But I'm going to be speaking to two people who have a most unusual effort here in Bedford. When my wife Jackie and I arrived in Bedford, one of the first attractions we saw outside of the obvious Fort Bedford Museum was the museum of the National Museum of the Coverlet. What am I saying this right, Melinda? What is it?
It's the National Museum of the American Coverlet.
National Museum of the American Coverlet. And I saw this beautiful old school building, which didn't know what to make of it. So we went in and we met these two lovely people and were revealed to this absolutely wondrous display of what I ignorantly called a bunch of bedspreads. I didn't know what they were. I have the two experts to explain to me what it is. First of all, Laszlo and Melinda have had this for 10 years. This is their 10th anniversary coming up on this wonderful museum. So I want to thank you very much, both of you, for taking time to talk to us. It's really been
pleasure.
A lot of fun today. Let me start with you, Melinda. First of all, fix me on the name. Why is it the National Museum? What makes it national?
We refer to ourselves as the National Museum because we are national in scope. We are interested in 19th century bed covers in every state where they were produced. In other words, for example, Pennsylvania produced more of one type of coverlet than any other state, but just because we're located in Pennsylvania doesn't mean that we're just interested in Pennsylvania. So we wanted to make it clear, especially to coverlet people, that that our collection includes coverlets from all over the country. National, I'll tell you what national does not mean, and that's almost more important in some ways. National does not mean that we get any kind of government or support from the government of any kind. We're a nonprofit, but we run on admissions, donations, shop sales, memberships, the occasional grant, program events, and stuff like that. So there are two reasons why we have that word national in there.
Well, that's a good reason. Laszlo, your background in this, I understand, is significant. How did you and Melinda come together on this whole coverlet idea? I understand there was something to do with your romance, I heard. Is that true, or is that just a rumor?
I'm an old antiques dealer, and antiques includes antique textiles.
Okay.
Within that coverlet, one of my main interests, when I met Melinda at an antique show in Danbury, Connecticut, we found out that she's also interested in coverlets. And we got together. Shortly after that, we married, and we are pursuing this endeavor.
So you could say that coverlets is really what sparked
what
the whole
us
thing.
Together.
Oh, yeah, no question.
So
I mean,
this isn't just...
We met because of coverlets.
She liked coverlets. I had coverlets.
Yeah.
So
and
the man with coverlets,
interest,
that's what did it.
Sealed our fate.
Okay, so what we need you to do for us right now is give us a pretty good definition of what a coverlet is.
That's the first question that a lot of folks ask, as you can imagine. And we always start with the definition of a quilt, because everybody knows what a quilt is. So it's easy to go from a common denominator. Coverlets, like quilts, are the topmost covering on a bed. But people think of quilts, for example, and I'm going to compare the two back and forth here. Quilts are generally thought of as being made by women. Nowadays it's a little bit of everybody, you know, more and more men are getting into this. But you think of quilts as being cut and pieced from existing cloth and then sandwiched together with something, and then the stitching will hold it all together and sometimes form a pattern of its own. Whereas a coverlet is woven on a loom. The textile itself is built from scratch, one row at a time. Every time the weaver throws the shuttle, he's building one more row in that textile, and the pattern is woven in as part of the process. So there are differences there. Another difference is that coverlets are made by both men and women. There were quite a number of men involved in this, male professional weavers, that is. And coverlets are, generally speaking, more often made of cotton and wool. The materials are very often hand-spun and hand-dyed, so you're talking about an awful lot of handwork involved in a textile that's being created from scratch. And indeed, the coverlets that we specialize in, antique coverlets, are 19th century. The earliest one in the collection, for example, is 1771. And then they range all the way in our collection through 1889. But the big, the big bubble of production, the big time frame, would be late 1830s to late 1850s.
Mm-hmm. Laszlo, when I first came here, you gave a rather eloquent tour of the coverlets and the machines that made them.
Well, weaving is ancient. As we know, is weaving, the loom, is about 7,000 years old.
That's pretty old, right?
That's pretty old. Now we are talking about this country. This country, obviously, the settler comes to this country, has nothing. So the first thing he does is build a loom in order to weave all textiles he needs. That includes bedding. Within bedding, a decorative top piece is a coverlet.
We take a lot for granted today, don't we? The fact that when you move into your new house, you have to make a machine to make your clothes and your bedspreads.
Yes, sir, that's what it was.
Well, yeah. And you mentioned that you hit the nail on the head, too. It's not just about bed hangings. This is about clothing, too. If you wanted clothes on your back, and presumably you did, that cloth had to come from somewhere. So the folks who were doing coverlets were doing a lot more than decorative bed covers. You know, the textiles in general play a big part, because we were established as colonies. We weren't supposed to produce finished goods. As people started to do more and more of this kind of thing on their own, it obviously had a big effect on taxes and all the whole relationship with Great Britain and all the stuff that you studied in high school. So, you know, when we talk about decorative bed covers, it's just that it's the tip of the iceberg, and we like to get into that in as much detail as anyone is interested in discussing.
Our guests today are Melinda and Laszlo Zangor of the National Museum of the American Coverlet. We're right here at Watson Street and Juliana Street in downtown Bedford. If you've not had an opportunity to see this place, just go to where I find the locals call the old school, and you're here. I also have noticed something about Bedford County. It takes a while for your new enterprise or new name to be accepted. So 10 years... and they're still calling you the old school. Could be a while, I guess, but that's just the way it is. Our wonderful guests have an enormous museum here. The ceilings are high, where you can hang the coverlets from the walls. They've got it very nicely laid out. You actually see a little system of where the looms in the first room are primitive, and then they go more sophisticated. Laszlo, can you tell us a little bit about the looms themselves? These were handmade, I guess, as well.
The museum only handles hand-produced material. In other words, we are talking about hand-woven coverlets, hand-spun material, hand-dyed material. There are two kinds of looms that produce coverlets. There are many, many details. There are many other things. But the basic fact is two kinds of looms. The first type, the ancient loom system, is the treadle and shaft loom, that can only produce straight lines, vertical and horizontal lines. So anything and everything that comes up that loom is referred to as a geometric design, a geometric pattern. Obviously, as the population is growing, more and more need, more and more people, cities growing, and this system becomes too slow and too limited. So in 1827 or 29, we don't know exactly the date, in comes a new system from Europe, the Jacquard system, invented in Lyon, France in 1801, comes to this country in 1827 or 29, and this system, instead of treadles and shaft, will use a punch card system, where the punch card system carries the information and attached to the old loom will weave faster and a much richer design. Whatever is in the punch card can be woven. So we break away from the limitations of geometric weaving straight lines only. We weave not only much more elaborate design, but also this system enables the weaver to put information into his weaving.
I want you to hold that thought, because when we come back, Laszlo is going to give you an astonishing fact that this technology he's talking about with the punch cards led to something far more modern today when Bedford County Speaks continues.
Hello, I'm Mark Thomas. So often, when you want to buy a car or truck, you're told to make sure you get a good deal. So what is a good deal? Is it just the price of the vehicle, or is it something else? At Thomas Chevrolet, we think that a good deal means everything that's important to us. Things like our multi-generational reputation for honesty and integrity, or the free inspection service you get on your purchase after you roll out of here, or the fact that your car or truck has been checked thoroughly by our factory-trained service department to make sure it's safe, or that we're a family-owned dealership that feels a responsibility to our customers. That's what a good deal means to us. How about you? The next time you need a car or truck, visit Thomas Chevrolet Subaru first. We'll show you what a good deal really is.
Thomas Chevrolet Subaru, where buying a car or truck is always worry-free.
This is Christian Heilman of WTAJ, and you're listening to Bedford County Speaks over News Talk 1310 WBFD.
Now, let's head back to today's Bedford County Speaks.
We are back at the National Museum of the American Coverlet with our guests, Melinda and Laszlo Zangor. And just a reminder that the Bedford County Chamber of Commerce proudly supports and celebrates the business community of the Bedford County region. To learn more, visit them online at thebedfordcountychamber.com. That's bedfordcountychamber.com. This has been a fascinating subject with Melinda and Laszlo. And before the break, I promised to bring Laszlo back to talk about these cards, and I will in a minute. But first, I want to talk a little bit about what it's like to walk into this museum. It really is quite unusual. Usually you walk in, they have a big wall explaining things. You don't see any of that here, so that's interesting. So what do you do with your visitor the minute they walk in?
Well, generally speaking, when somebody comes in, the first thing they see is that it's a bigger building than they thought it was. They are invited to step into the shop where they will meet Laszlo, who will offer them a tour of the museum. We take them through four large exhibition spaces and a hallway that extends the length of the building. For the current exhibition, they will see 100 coverlets hanging, which is a pretty big exhibition. I mean, generally speaking, most museums, if they have a coverlet showing at all, it'll be one or two or three. So this is a big deal. We have changing exhibitions. The current exhibition, which is now up, is featuring animals in coverlets. It's something of a Noah's Ark. We entitled it Lions and Tigers, No Bears, oh my. And the reason for that is that we've never seen a bear in a coverlet for some reason.
Really?
A lot of people get very excited about that, so we'd like to explain why we said that. But every one of the 100 coverlets has animals of some kind. Some of them are quite big and some of them are quite little tiny ones. When we did the photography for the catalog, we were crazy enough to actually count the animals in each coverlet. One of them has 480 eagles in it, for an example. Hmm. So there are over 6,800 animals depicted, everything from butterflies and barnyard animals to African animals and everything in between. But each visitor is treated to a tour. It is not canned. It is not pre-recorded. It is all in direct response to the interest level and the questions that that particular visitor asks. They also have a chance to see some of the early weaving equipment, some of the hardest shaft looms like what Lasso was referring to. We have a jack hard head that gives people an idea of how that punch card system works. They have a chance to see spinning wheels and so on and so forth, and we walk through and explain the differences between the two types of coverlets. Lasso referred to that briefly, the geometric ones that were made very often by women, but also very often by men, depending on locality. And then they have a chance to see a number of figured coverlets, which were primarily woven by male professional weavers. And that's always a big surprise to the guys who come in. You know, most folks will come in as a couple, and he's sort of humoring the little lady because he thinks this is girl stuff. And by the time he's had a chance to walk through with his wife, he gets, you know, intrigued by the technology of it. It's the usual comment that we hear at the end is, gee, I never knew, this is really cool. And that's the whole idea. You know, we're not right. trying to turn out major collectors or anything. We just want people to become a little bit more aware of the heritage of textile production in this country. So if they have a chance to see something beautiful in the process, that's cool.
One of the things that I find very interesting, having come from the Philadelphia area, there isn't a colonial museum in Philadelphia that does not feature sometimes somewhere a spinning wheel. Mm-hmm. You're always seeing sure. somebody with a spinning wheel. Mm-hmm. We used to live in Chads Ford, and Chads Ford days had all kinds of spinning wheels. Go to Independence Park, spinning wheels. Mm-hmm. You have one here. And I learned something here at this museum. I did not hear learned at any of those colonial museums, and that was what stuff goes into a spinning wheel. Mm-hmm. Now, where's the thread come from?
Yeah.
Well, of course, the spinning wheel makes the thread. That's the whole idea. I understand that some of this stuff was made from flax.
Right.
And flax to me looked like hay.
Yeah.
So what is flax? And how does it work in a spinning wheel? I've never understood that. And that's one thing you explain here. It's pretty interesting.
Yeah, it's as you can imagine, it's always easier to show somebody than it is to describe it over the radio. But flax, the flax plant when it's growing in the field is producing very pretty little blue flowers. It's a very lovely plant. But the end product when you're talking about spinning flax would be linen. It's a very time-consuming process. It's a lot. There's a lot more labor involved than producing cotton, for example. Cotton, everybody knows what the cotton plant looks like, or at least I hope everybody does. Right. Everybody does. It's very interesting to see. And when we were all in school, at least my generation, we learned about getting the seed out of the cotton and what a big deal that was. But cotton is considerably less labor-intensive than linen is, and that's why when cotton became available mill run fairly early, which is pretty close to the beginning of the 19th century, depending on where you were in the country, it very quickly replaced linen as the fiber, the fiber of favor, the desired fiber in a coverlet. So you do see linen coverlets once in a while, but not as often as
cotton. It's kind of the 19th century version of Kmart clothes as opposed to linen, which was more expensive. Is that...
Well, yes and no. Linen to this day, I mean, even now, if you go to try to find anything linen, which is getting yeah. harder and harder to do anymore, but linen always was and always will be more expensive
sure.
because even though nowadays everything is industrialized, it's still a lot more work.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you're working with the flax plant, you're going for the individual fibers in the stalk of that plant. So you have to soak it and crimp it and separate it and comb it and do all this stuff to it before you even get it onto the spinning wheel to twist it and make a yarn out of it. So whereas, you know, getting the seed out of the cotton is it's one or two, you're carding it and then you're ready to.
Well, I brought this up because
it's a little bit quicker,
I brought this up because I wanted to demonstrate just how difficult it was then to even make an article of clothing.
Oh yeah.
As Lasso said, they made everything. So we're just still talking about the yarn. Haven't gotten to the cloth yet.
You haven't even gotten onto the loom yet. You're doing all that preparation work. You have to produce, one way or another, you have to produce that yarn and get it ready to put onto the loom. So this is another one of the key differences, for example, between a coverlet and a quilt is that you are producing that coverlet from scratch, essentially.
Gotcha.
It's much more elastic. 99 times out of 100, if somebody has a question for us, the first two words of our response are going to be, it depends. Because it depends on where you were in the country, what your local economy was, what your local geography was, whether or not you had a population center to support certain kinds of weaving. So it's a very interesting thing to study. The cool thing about all these, I guess, if I was to put it a little more succinctly than I have managed to do so far, is that you can come in and walk through and say, wow, these are really beautiful. You know, you can walk through without learning a thing about them and say, these are really beautiful. It's really cool. I'm glad I saw these. But if you take an extra minute or two to learn a little bit more about it, a few basics, you get so much more out of it. And that's kind of what we're at.
Laszlo, one of the things that just astonishes me is I look at these coverlets and I see these fantastic designs. And just before the break, you had mentioned that was Jacquard had come up with this card. And in the card are holes. And this sure sounds like something from 20th century technology. Tell me the connection.
The simple fact is the card carries the information. Depending on where you place the hole on the card will tell the loom the next step will translate the design. So this is 1801 invention. The short story is simple. Invented by a silk weaver. Silk production was very important to France because the income came from silk production. So Napoleon, who wanted more money, impressed it upon the silk weavers. He wants a better system. Mm-hmm. And out of this comes Mr. Jacquard's invention, the punch card system operated loom attachment. This gets added to the loom, hooked to the loom. Very simply, the threads get hooked to the word threads, the vertical threads, and the card one by one comes down in front of a reader. The reader reads where the holes are placed, translate this into how these threads are being lifted. And as the system will function according to this, we'll put a design in. This is 1804. The market in Europe accepts this, and Europe turns to the Jacquard system as a weaving system.
So it was really the world's first automation, wasn't it?
Well, we can repeat and repeat and repeat. However, it's still a hand-woven product. To make your life more complicated, aside from building a loom, dressing a loom, providing the materials that you yourself grew, cotton and wool or linen wool combination, now you have to punch cards, put the information into the card that will generate this design. So, though it looks like it's simple, you sit at the loom and the cards are coming down one by one by one, and you weave 24 times faster than the hand.
So this is the 19th century computer programmer, if you will, making these cards. Yes, and they hand them over to these weavers who put them on their looms as a retrofit almost.
Hand woven. The weaver's still sitting there throwing the shuttle. It's just a faster, more efficient way of lifting those threads so that the correct threads can rise or drop so that when he throws the shuttle, he's creating that pattern. It enables him to weave faster and more complicated patterns, you know, flowers, that kind of stuff, but it's still hand woven. So it does lead to the modern computer, but it's not a machine. It is very often referred to as a machine. It's really no more of a machine than a hammer is. You know, it's still hand operated.
Well, you know, what interesting though is the whole notion of being able to replicate a design over and over through these cards, and that's kind of what I meant when I said it's more of a computer.
So the weaver becomes more productive.
Sure. Yeah. And of course, there's less of his creativity involved because the card's already determined that. But,
because a lot of these guys did their own design work. Don't forget. Mm-hmm. In some cases, they could, when they put, this is where it gets a little complicated, but in some cases, these weavers would purchase that Jacquard head and it would come with a set of cards. If they didn't know how to change anything, mm-hmm. then they could use that set of cards until that set of cards wore out, which it eventually would do. But a lot of these guys did their own design work, so they not only had to know how to set up the loom and fix it and run it and do the math to figure out how much material they needed, but once they would have to dream up that pattern, transfer it to point paper, essentially, and then transfer that information to those cards, which in many cases they made themselves.
As I mentioned, when the visitor first comes in, they see this wonderful display. You do, in fact, have looms here, and you do, in fact, show how they work, mm-hmm. including a large jacquard room mm-hmm. in one of your rooms. What do you tell them about that loom, either one of you? What would you tell them about the jacquard loom when they come?
Well,
we both offer tours. We kind of go back and forth.
Okay.
We offer very different tours. I tend to get probably a little more technical than he does, but he's really the good one at explaining the local color and the background that goes into the development of all this.
The system is basically you lift threads and feeding wool between creating your design.
Gotcha.
Whether it's geometric or jacquard, the same. The jacquard system, what's interesting and important about the jacquard system, we didn't get to it yet, is indeed, this is invented in 1801, becomes generally used in Europe by 1804, creates an enormous problem, because yes, you can produce more and a richer design, but you created unemployment.
Ah.
When you weave 24 times faster, you threw 23 weavers out of a job. So the unemployed is a problem. Everybody's happy with the jacquard system, but the unemployed need a job. Since it's not available in Europe, they get on the boat and they go to where they are needed, which is the U.S. Mm. In comes the unemployed European weaver joining the American farmer weaver, weaving the old way until this new system comes to Philadelphia in 1829, and switching to the jacquard system, all of a sudden we have coverlets with a richer design and dates and names and locations.
Made here.
Made here in the U.S. in various states.
Last week you had a wonderful presentation here with the Garden Club, and so you do a lot of different things here at this museum, don't you? Not just coverlets. You have events sometimes?
Yeah, we have special events on-site and off-site. Every September we do a special weekend that we refer to as Coverlet College, and we do presentations and hands-on opportunities and show and tell. And the last year we added some workshops for anybody. It's open to anybody who is interested in learning a little more and getting a little bit more deeply into this. It's a really fun opportunity for newbies to meet people who have been around them for a very long time. We average about 50 people. We had a natural dyeing workshop this last time, which was a biggie. We had a representative up from Colonial Williamsburg who led that, and it was a big hit. We did the Garden Club tour here in Bedford a week ago, which was a big success. We are looking at starting a textile program here. Mm. We've just this past year, this past summer, been given from three different sources. We've been given a total of 17 contemporary looms. So it's sort of the key to the next stage of the next phase, if you will, of what we wanted to do here from day one, and that is to offer workshops and classes and so on for not only for weaving, but crocheting and knitting and rug hooking and all kinds of textiles, and that's something that we will hope to be ramping up starting this spring. We have an event coming up in June, which will be the official celebration of our 10th anniversary. That's June of 2016, obviously. And we've already got a hook-in schedule, a class for rug hookers, and we'll have that'll be a three-day class, and we'll have a hook-in on Saturday. We'll have a show of hooked rugs that are themed with animals to sort of coincide with the exhibition we have going. So there's stuff going on all the time. We're adding new things. And for those people who are not here, if you've never been to the Maryland Sheep and Wool Festival in May, that's a really cool thing to get to. So we do that. We do that too. We go down there.
Melinda, Laszlo, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us. This has been a fascinating visit. And I know you're one of the few in the country that do this, so perhaps we'll come back someday and learn some more about what happens at the National Museum and the American Coverlet. But I want to thank you very much for both of you joining us and taking the time to talk to us.
And we thank you very much for the attention.
Thank you very much. Thanks. Bedford County Speaks was brought to you today by DestinationDelco.com and by Thomas Chevrolet Subaru, where buying a car is always worry-free. If you'd like to hear today's program again, just visit BedfordCountySpeaks.com. I look forward to joining you next time right here on News Talk 1310 WBFD. Until then, have a great weekend. This is Lloyd Roach.
You have been listening to Bedford County Speaks. Listen each Saturday beginning at 8:30 to hear about the work, lives, and lifestyles in Bedford County. Bedford County Speaks is a presentation of the News and Public Affairs Department of News Talk 1310 WBFD. Thanks for listening.